Hello, all, and welcome to another episode of Goddess Talks on the Goddess Project podcast. Today, we are talking to Karen Tate. I had the most wonderful, like naturally genuine, amazing conversation with Karen Tate. If you haven't heard or read any of her books or listened to her podcast, Karen Tate is a leader, speaker, activist. She's a seven-time published author, and her work bridges the spirituality between personal transformation and social justice. She hosts a long-time-running podcast called Voices of the Sacred Feminine Podcast, and I've put that in the description below. Over a decade long, right? Even before podcasts were podcasts. She is very influential in the goddess spirituality movement, and she's part of the caring economy conversation. She wrote several books, but the book that we're talking about mostly in this podcast is called Sacred Places of the Goddess, 108 Destinations, Walking an Ancient Path. And I can't wait for you guys to hear all of her travel stories for the goddess at Goddess Sites. And she is actually an interfaith minister as well. She leads sacred tours, rituals. She speaks at major conferences. And she is herself in service to the goddess Isis, which she talks about often. And she talks about in this particular episode as well. So I'm very excited. There are links below and descriptions below to her work, her books, her podcast. I'm very excited for you all to watch this episode. We had such a blast recording it, and so much natural sharing. And I hope that you will really enjoy it and pick up her book, and maybe one day visit some of the places that we have talked about here. So here we go. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we enjoyed recording it. Let me record. Perfect. Okay. So welcome, Karen Tate, to the Goddess Project, Goddess Talks. It's so wonderful to have you here and learn about your work and your research and all of that.
Well, thank you, Carla. I looked forward to being here with you because I felt like, you and I are unicorns a little bit, because there aren't many people that do what you do and I did. And it feels like we're just sort of a natural fit with this, this very similar background of goddess and sacred tours. And I'm just looking forward to chatting with you about this a lot.
Yes. And I'm also really glad to have you here and to share with everyone your work, because I think it's just so important. And your book for me was so important, your Goddess Sites book. And you're right. I was also thinking, well, if more and more of us plotted or created these spaces, then perhaps future generations will have more and more tools to go to these sites and experience these sites.
Well, I hope so, because, when I wrote that Sacred Places book, and that's back, I want to say maybe, 2009, but, a travel book doesn't get dated, because obviously we're talking about things thousands of years old. So a couple decades hardly matters.
Yes.
There were not established goddess tours then. The only other person that was out there doing it maybe was Carol Christ.
Yes.
Taking people. And that was just primarily to Crete and maybe Greece.
Yeah.
And so my husband and I started doing these travels on our own independently. And because we were part-time travel agents, I did a couple with other travel agents on tours.
Oh,
but
nice.
then yeah, but then we broke out and started doing our own, because this became so important to me, and the effect it had on me was so profound. I thought, I want other people to experience this. And there were not, number one, there weren't established tours that you could take that took you to goddess sites. You had to have your own unique, independent travel itinerary. So after I visited these places or researched these places, I had to create the travel itineraries myself. And taught some of these tour agencies out there, that there are people who want to go to these places. And I think they started to, pick up the baton, some of them, like the Irish tours and the Turkish tours. And they learned from my itineraries, quite frankly,
And I agree. I mean, your work was so foundational, and it might sound shocking to some people, but I remember I went to go see the first time I went to go see Buran was in 2010. And I was with my mother, and we were on a Greek tour. And Buran was an established temple site with a museum. And I was asking my tour guide, "Hey, have you heard of this Artemis at Ravona? Okay, Ravona, fine. At Buran, etc." She had no idea what I was talking about. She spoke to a couple of other people. She was very nice, but she spoke to a couple other people to try and tell me where it was. And it took three or four or five different tour guides to find where it was. And then she tried to explain to me how to get there, and how to get there was a whole adventure. When I got there, it was completely empty and peak tourist season, completely empty. The museum was empty. And this was 2010. Now, I think, and I hope I've been there again a couple of times, and there was more people on site. I was there in January 2024. But it's amazing to me that these sites that were already, so they're already established tourist sites, never mind the ones that we find that are sort of off the beaten path, weren't getting visitors. Or it's
Like, for instance, oh, well, gee, what you just said brings up so many things. Like Sardis, for instance, in
oh.
Turkey, this beautiful Artemis temple with this picturesque mountain behind the temple. I mean, there's even a stele there, dedicated to a priestess of Artemis. We were there by ourselves. We did yoga on the platform for the temple to like awaken the day,
Oh.
I mean, in other stuff like that too. I mean, Lagina, the only standing temple to Hecate, nobody there really,
Yes. Yes.
Instead, people are going off on, oh, the footsteps of Saint Paul, and all of these goddess sites, or so many of them. But like you said about Buran, nobody took us there. I missed that. And you really have to be careful when you take these escorted tours, because they'll say in the description, you're going to see the Temple of Artemis in Ephesus, and you don't know. Wait, we just saw it looking out the window of the bus going 50 miles an hour.
No, no.
I mean, that can really happen. That happened to me on a tour. Fortunately, I had seen it myself, but I thought, my God, if this was the only time I was going to get to Greece, and that description from that tour operator misled me. I thought we were stopping there, not waving to it out the window of the bus.
Yes. And and all of the things that you've said. So we were just in Turkey in November. We were at Sardis as well. Early morning, okay. But again, totally empty, no sign of life. They're still doing a little bit of digging, which is great. Such a great site. We had, because it was November, we had mist, we had fog, we had all these great things. Then the same thing. We went to Hekatia at Lagina. There was actually there a few younger people who were hanging around. So hopefully that's getting a little more sort of playtime and people know. When I posted a video of Lagina, it went viral on TikTok. It went nuts because people are really interested in the site. But when you get to Turkey, okay, it is a little bit out of the way, but no one tells you, "Hey, let's go to here." And the same thing for Artemis of Ephesus. So I was just there. Now we were there on our own. There are no guards at the Temple of Artemis of Ephesus. There were people climbing that column where I had to be a little bit. I'm not normally like a jerk like that, but I was like, no, you can't climb that. You have to get down. but no guards, nothing. And when we did arrive, there was maybe like two people there, and then this guy that was selling something. I don't know what he was selling, some kind of book, something. And he was like, "Oh, well, here's just a column. So, like, don't worry, there's not much to see." And my partner, my travel partner, Sandra, was like, "Oh, no, you're talking to the wrong woman."
Well, when we were in Delphi, they take everybody up to the main site, right? But just down the street is that beautiful temple, and I always get the Artemis and the Athena mixed up.
Yes, yes.
You miss that incredible temple. We walked back to it in order to see it and spend time at it. And across the street was what we I think it's the Castilian Spring. I mean, there was actually a bath where they would roll, you could see where they would roll a stone to either stop or start the water in this rectangle pool, so to speak. And I felt really strongly people must have purified themselves right there before maybe they went to the temple,
Yeah.
And so we actually did that.
Oh.
We were there. It was so funny. Here we were in our t-shirts and tennis shoes, and we were able to get some of the sacred water there, and we were like purifying ourselves. And we felt like we had this direct connection to priestesses past.
Yes.
Here we were doing it again. Maybe we weren't in our sacred priestess regalia, but we were, perpetuating the lineage of goddess in, in our century.
I love that. I love that. I know, I think you're talking about the Tholos of Athena, which is on the other side at the bottom there.
Yes.
The first time that I visited, I had this really strong feeling that this shouldn't belong to Athena. And there's really no explanation why they named it for Athena. So part of me, one day, once I have all this other work, Artemis work done, may go back and try and figure out if I can come up with some explanation of why this clearly would have been to Artemis rather than Athena. But anyway, that's a side story. But I didn't see the bath that you're talking. I did see, they have the water that comes down that you could fill up your water bottles with.
It's right near there.
Yeah.
And we had a funny story about that. When we got there, we were all collecting sacred water along the trip because that was when you could travel with liquid, before 9/11 and so we were collecting sacred water to bring home to our altars to do ritual with and stuff. And there was an it, just a throng, a swarm of bees at those sinks where you get the water. And, of course, bees, the Melissae, all of that. But we were afraid to go collect the water because we didn't want to get stung. And my husband was so cool. He always went on all the sacred tours. 9 times out of 10, he was one of the only men. He would keep track of all of us, make sure everybody got on the bus. In fact, in Egypt, one of the tomb keepers there saw him walking with all of us in white galabayas and said, "These your women?" And he and Roy, I mean, in this his limited English, right? And so Roy shook his head, yes. And he goes, "Oh, strong man." Because I think the guy thought that was Roy's harem, but getting back to the sacred water at Delphi, Roy said, I'll do this. I'll do this. 'Cause Roy's always been like an animal whisperer kind of. And so he just started talking to the bees and gently said to them why we were there, what we wanted to do. Please let us, have the gift of their sacred water. He went up to the sink. He was swarmed, but they not one stung him. And he filled up all of our water bottles. I'm getting goosebumps right now thinking about it, It
Wow.
was just one of those sacred travel stories that you remember the rest of your life because it was special, It just was not your mundane stuff.
Wow. That is amazing. That bees are such a good sort of measurement tool for your connection to the divine. I mean, I see them often when I climb on the mountains, especially in Crete. There are bees everywhere, and there's been moments when it's very much no, like you cannot go through here. And then there's moments where it is, like you say, magical, where it seems like you are allowed to have access
Yeah.
to.
Well, you know, another thing, and look, it could have just been the season and the temperature and all of that, but we all, you know, a lot of times we felt like we were followed by these little tiny yellow butterflies too.
Oh.
And I don't know, you know, I learned, I mean, I'm very left brain, so I really had to learn to look for the signs and the symbols and not to, you know, poo-poo it as just, you know, because I figure, okay, you can do what you want with the ideas that enter your head. You know, maybe you're claircognizant, maybe you're losing your mind. I don't know. But, you know, sometimes I felt like these were really signs of everyday magic
Yeah.
that we should pay attention to because, you know, we expect the big magic, you know, oh, we're going to see an apparition, you know.
Yes.
But, you know, sometimes it's just the little magic that's the real magic.
Yes.
So.
Yes. It's so interesting how so many of us approach this from that cerebral perspective.
Yeah.
You know, I've promised myself that from now on, I'm going to have to start writing down the moments that feel non-cerebral, because what happens is I'm in them, I experience them, and then as time passes, I either sort of forget about them or push them to the side. And I've promised myself, no, I'm going to write something in the moment. And then when I go back to it, it'll have that raw feeling again that I haven't just dismissed.
Yeah.
Explained
Well,
away.
that's hard to do. I mean, that's really hard to do because I promised myself after every tour I would do that. And I didn't because I'd get caught up in getting back into the world and I'd never get to it.
You're right.
And you know, and I noticed another thing because back then we were still using video cameras, right? I'm dating myself.
Yeah.
And I would video so many of the sacred sites, and I'm glad I did because now I still have that video, if it's any good. But when you're looking at these sites from behind the lens of a video camera, you really do miss something. You know, there's an energetic difference. And also, if you're a tour leader and you have the responsibility of other people, either A, just making sure you don't lose anybody, or B, you know, like us, maybe we were doing ritual or divination or something at the site,
Yeah.
you're on, you're working, you
Yeah.
know, and it's hard to, you know, connect with that sacred site and have the experience when you're working and have to sit, stay focused on, you know, you promise these people this experience and lagging us, so you gotta, you know, you gotta do it, you know.
Yes. Yes.
So when you go to these places, Carla, are you mostly by yourself with somebody else, or are you with a big group?
No. So I have a travel partner. So in the beginning, I was alone, and the very early phases. And then I have a travel partner now. Her name is Sandra. And so we travel together for the mapping project. She does so much of the organization. I do the driving. She's the GPS. So it works really, really well. And she's a photographer of archaeology. So she can spend hours at a site or a museum, which allows me to repeatedly film things or whatever. So, but sometimes she doesn't hike to the highest peaks because her knee is bothering, you know, it's not good. So sometimes I will hike alone. Often, if there's a hike up a mountain, like if we're on a site, like a flat site, no problem. But if it's up a mountain or somewhere that requires something else, I will go by myself. But either way, so when I'm by myself, it's true. That's when I've had some of these moments that are really unexplainable otherwise, you know what I mean, Karen? Like it's
Yeah,
really
yeah.
like my cerebral brain tries to explain it, but it's like, okay, but that's a lot, Carla. But even with just her, because we're both very calm earth signs, there's a lot of room to just enjoy the space, to walk through the space, to so I have been asked, and I'm working with another person, another woman, on maybe putting together a trip for 2026 at some of these temples. But in putting it together, as you say, in putting it together now, we're gonna do 2 weeks, I think, or whatever, 1 week and 1 week. I've got all these places that I think that we should go see and that are fantastic. But in the reality of taking people on a group tour is that, you have to give people a minute to breathe, maybe shop, maybe go to we're going to organize some activities. And so I have to have patience that and accept that we might only see three or four sites out of 20. And I think based on what you've said and what others have said is I have to be prepared that I'm creating the space for these individuals. It's not a me and Artemis time, in the way that you're saying it,
And cutting off those others in the itinerary is like cutting off limbs.
It is.
Well, you reminded me of a tour I put together. It was a small tour. It was one of my first ones. I think there was only six people besides me and my husband. And this woman went on the sacred sites carrying a portable harp
Oh.
because she had gotten a download from the goddess that she was supposed to clean and clear the energies at each of these sites.
Okay.
So she would take this harp out and play it. Now, it was beautiful. In fact, at one of these places, I think it was on Delos, the wind was, had whipped up a little bit, and she took her hands off the harp and the wind actually played the strings.
Oh.
It was incredible. I again, I'm getting goosebumps remembering it. But I'll tell you, she was one of the biggest problems on the trip because after every time she did that at a site, oh, she expected everybody in the group to now heal her. She wanted a group healing. And then her husband, who didn't care about any of this, but he was paying the bill for her and him, right? All he could think about was eating and drinking. And, he wanted to, I mean, he would expect us to miss a site so that he could eat at 6 o'clock,
Sweet
So, I
goddess.
mean, there's so much to think about when you put a tour together, so much to think about. I
Yes.
had a woman who believed I didn't know it till after the fact. She was taking mood altering medication. She thought that being in the sacred sites would take the place of the mood altering medication. So she went off her meds.
Oh
I'm
my God.
telling you, every time I came home from a sacred tour, I added to my tours and conditions. Because you just can't even anticipate
Yes.
some of the things people are going to do and want and
Yes.
expect.
Yes. It's funny you say that because, I've been working and I'm working long term to build an Artemis Center, a real one where women can come. And for a long time, I assumed that I would buy a piece of land, build what I can, and live there and also have the center there. This is the dream. But I've had several people say to me, Carla, are you sure you want to live on the land? Because people will come. And they have their expectations, they have their whatever personalities, they have whatever. And you may want to go home at night away from, and that, that's the same for on tour to be able to do some me time, because I am kind of an introvert, in many ways. And so sometimes too many people already sort of feel like, okay, I have people too much today. So I think that those are important. Yeah, just important advice to know as you, and also just fascinating experiences that you have, Karen, with so many personalities
Oh yeah. I
in
mean,
these places.
and there's more, I
Yeah.
mean, I should write a book about the tour experiences,
Should.
But you're saying that about living on the site. Have you ever been to the Sekhmet Temple outside Las Vegas in
I have
Indian
not.
Springs?
No. I've been invited to go, but I just haven't just haven't made it out there, as a Canadian going down to the States was is
Well,
always
and now you want to stay in Canada where you're safe and anyway, the thought that anybody in Canada would want to come, to think that Canada would want to be part of the United States and lose your social safety net, people must be out of their mind. I mean, I think it shows how stupid he is or how stupid he thinks. Anyway, all right, I digress. So, The Sekhmet Temple outside Las Vegas. I love Sekhmet. She's like primary for me, like Isis is. And we would visit that sacred site, half a dozen times I've been there. And the site exists there because a woman by the name of Genevieve Vaughan, wealthy woman, she visited Egypt and she couldn't have children. She had tried for years and years. She learned about Sekhmet being a healing goddess, a mother goddess, and she saw Sekhmet, and I think it might have been the British Museum, I forget. And it was one of, and she came across one of what they call the essential statues that some people think they've seen move.
Ah, yes.
And Rob Masters, what's his first name? Robert Masters, I think, writes about the essential statues of Sekhmet, Jean Houston's husband.
Ah.
Anyway, she came upon this statue. I'm pretty sure part of the story is she thought she saw it move. That's kind of irrelevant, or maybe it's irrelevant. Anyway, she made a promise to Sekhmet right there and then and said, "If I become pregnant, I will build you a temple." After years of not becoming pregnant, she goes home. Within a few months, she's pregnant.
No,
So
wow.
she keeps her promise. She builds this Sekhmet, a small shrine on what is Shoshone Indian reservation on the land. She made an arrangement with them or something. I don't know that part of the deal, but it was actually on a nuclear, on land that had been affected by nuclear power. And
Wow.
they, part of the reason they put it there was to help heal the land. But where I'm going with this story, besides kind of a tip for Americans that, they can visit a goddess site in the States without traveling abroad,
Yeah.
is I noticed that after a while, it felt like to me that site started to become a dumping ground for people's energy.
Ah.
And I'm thinking about you living there on the site. And it really needed an intense cleansing because I think people went there with their sorrows and with their pains and hurts and regrets and prayed to the goddess there and maybe left it for her to transmute, to
Yeah.
transform.
Yeah.
But you could still feel the heaviness,
I've never thought that is such a good point, Karen, because I do talk about how temple sites still carry the energies of ancient people's ritual, but until just now I hadn't thought about, yeah, you're right. People come and leave their energies wherever you create a sacred site.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you would probably need an annual or a biannual
Yeah.
cleansing ritual or something,
Also
you know,
explains
to
why
feel.
so many of the temples did annual cleansing, why they took the cult statues and cleansed them,
Yeah.
right? All of that was part of the yearly ritual as well in ancient temples.
Yeah. And so that's kind of insight on maybe it wasn't just a routine, washing to clean it of dust or something,
Yeah.
but more than that,
Yeah, I love that. And thank you for that tip. Now, for sure, I will not be living there. I mean, the reality of building it is complicated because, for a while, I was actually thinking of building it in the States, like it was the States or Crete. But Greece is complicated to build on and to have goddess worship right now. So I was thinking, you know what? If they give me a really hard time, I'm going to pray on it, talk to the goddess, see if she wants to be somewhere else. And so I thought, oh, the States would be great because it's a place where you could buy a piece of land and do whatever you want. Or at least it was. And so now I'm a little stuck. So, but there's lots to do in the meantime, and hopefully the right path will show up.
Yeah, I don't think what's going on now is going to last.
Yeah.
I think this time next year things are going to look very different. I pray anyway. I mean, I hope it's not wishful thinking, but I do believe it. You know how you get that certainty inside? I'm holding on to that, that She's saying, yes, this is a rocky road, but hold on, things are going to be better. Because, yeah, you're right. There's so much land here that's still available that you could probably get cheap. And, or if you go to a blue state, because, I'm surprised, honestly, that, I mean, it's to my knowledge, well, I will say the Sekhmet statue that was in Las Vegas, it was stolen. And it was broken into a bunch of pieces.
The
The
one that
first,
was at the temple in.
and yeah, outside
Oh.
Indian Springs, teenagers kidnapped it, vandalized it, and oh, there's a whole story there. They did a ritual to find out what happened to it because there's no cameras. And it was really funny after they did the ritual to try to find out what happened to it. One of the women that was mixed up in it actually called the temple anonymously and apologized and told them what happened.
Wow.
So they at least knew what happened to that original statue. And now they have a replacement there,
Okay. Okay.
but
Inside though, or outside still?
well, you see, it's outside. That's the problem.
Hmm.
If you look up the Sekhmet Temple in Indian Springs, you'll see it's this dome-like structure with, four doors that are just arched doorways,
Beautiful. Okay.
And I mean, it's a very simple place, but it's still beautiful and profound, and fire pit in the middle, and it's beloved.
Yeah.
And the people in Las Vegas, the pagans there visit it regularly and do ritual there. But anyway, I guess where I was going with this is I'm surprised to a certain extent that there's not more of that. And
Right.
I don't know if in the last 10 years things have gotten worse, but I don't know. I don't know. It's like I feel like we need a shield of invisibility around our sacred places,
Right.
at least right now.
Yeah.
And and I don't know about you, Carla, but what one of the things I wrote in my Sacred Places of Goddess book, because we're so isolated here in North America, I mean, like you and I have a passport and we've traveled, but I remember at one point only 15% of Americans had a passport, so they don't leave the United States.
Yeah.
And for someone who's interested in goddess, there's not a whole lot here in the States. And I started thinking about new ideas of goddess sites, and I actually added those in my Sacred Places book, like the Grand Canyon, for instance.
Wow.
There's seven ecosystems in the Grand Canyon, so goddess as nature is there. Plus, you have her sacred landscape because you have the mountains and you have the river, her body, her sacred blood.
Oh, I love that. Yes.
And then the National Park Service had named a lot of those peaks, and one of them was named Isis Peak.
That's
So
wonderful.
I thought about that being a sacred site, as well as the Statue of Liberty as our political
Yes.
goddess.
Yes.
And there was precedent for that because in Rome, I have to go back and look now. But the idea of freedom was revered. So in a sense, it was already deified.
Yeah.
I forget the terminology. I haven't talked about that in a while. But more so, that sacred that museums should be sacred sites for us,
Oh, I love that.
because there you have her image. You have her artifacts, you have her history.
Yeah.
So why not make the Rosicrucian Museum a sacred site? The New York museums that house so many artifacts, her sacred site.
Yeah.
Any place that has her presence,
Yeah.
we don't have to have an archaeological site,
Yeah. That's brilliant. Yes. And you know, it's funny you say that because, as you know, When you go to museums, there are statues. I've had a couple experiences with a couple of statues, Artemis statues, but even Sekhmet, to be honest, where you are stunned in front of the statue. You can't stop staring on it. There's a moment between you and the statue that is unusual,
Yeah, for
right?
me it was the Burney relief in the British Museum of, well, and for your listeners, that's like, well, is it Inanna? Is it Ishtar? Is it Lilith? But she's the one there with the bird feet and the two owls on either side. I swear to God, that statue, well, relief, it was pulling me. Pulling me in. It, like Outlander, where you touch the stones and you feel like it's going to take you somewhere. I swear to Goddess, I feel like if I touch that, I was going to be transported back. And in the other artifact there that was the very same for me, and it's so tiny, people might not even notice it, was the lady in the window. I mean, it was only about this big, and it was blue faience, and it was, I think it was supposed to be, they called it sacred prostitution, but who knows, right? It was a woman's face in a window, and that was a powerful, powerful little piece.
I'm not familiar
Yeah.
with that piece. That sounds interesting. I'm gonna look that up after. But yeah, I agree. I think that those are really I've had a couple of them. I've had one for sure at the ancient Mycenae Museum. There's a statue of Artemis the Huntress where I was like a little out of my mind for it. I couldn't stop staring at her. She kept pulling me in. I needed to touch her and I never touch artifacts. I can't remember actually now if but I lost like 10 minutes where my partner who was in the museum as well, she looked at me, she went, "What's going on with you?" And I was like, I can't stop staring at this. I can't stop looking at this statue. Like it's talking to me, like, And so again, my partner's
Yeah.
a lawyer, so she's a very cerebral
Yeah.
person, and she just goes, "Okay, all right." She's seen some strange things on our trip. But but so you get these reactions to some of the pieces. And so you're out
It's
in the
few and
US.
far between, too. I mean, it's few and far between. So we can't have listeners think, oh, well, they're going to go on a tour and this is going to happen. I mean, there's no telling if anything is going to happen, you know?
And everyone has different pieces, Everyone has different stories. Of
Yeah.
pieces that you're like, okay, I saw that piece, but I didn't really react in some way.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's so many different factors too. I mean, because I would usually have an orientation for my group the Friday night before the tour started. And one of the things we talked about, besides let's not be an ugly American, let's be an ambassador for our country. Was, how to connect at the sacred sites. And I would always tell people, don't drink, don't overeat, sleep well, don't have expectations, and then maybe you improve your chances. And then when you get there, be quiet, be quiet, try to find places alone, don't, but I had another one of those experiences in Japan. I was at a temple dedicated to Canon, who was like the Japanese counterpart for Kuan Yin. And, honestly, I'm not an Asian goddess person. I was visiting Japan to be able to write the Japanese part of my book. But we walked into one of these temples, and I think it was the Hasidera temple. I'd have to go back and look now. But I swear, if it hadn't been for the tourists all around, I wanted to throw myself on the ground and just bow before the statue. I mean, she was a humongous golden statue, and it was dark, and she was this golden presence. But I don't even think it was the fact that it looked so astonishing. It was the energy. There was the incense in the air, and but there was something there, and I really wanted to throw myself on the ground and just prostrate myself, prostrate myself. Anyway, look, go, all hail goddess kind of a thing. But I was too self-conscious. So I just stood there. I just stood there and tried to soak it in,
Wow. You remind me of a story I just had with the Artemis of Ephesus. And I think I've told the story before, but basically, I had this vision ahead of going to the Ephesian Museum that when I got there, I would be in a dark room with her and I would kneel. But when I got there, thank God that we were in November, so the museum was mostly empty. But when I got there, I was also self-conscious. I felt so it is in a dark room. There's those two statues. I don't know if you've probably been to the Ephesian Museum. Two statues on opposite sides, and it's a dark room, and just the statues are lit. But there's enough light that everyone can see everyone. And there's a guard. There's a guard. There was a female guard sitting in a chair. And I was like, okay, well, that's not going to happen because here I am, in this country that's very patriarchal, and I'm called to kneel in front of this goddess, but there's people coming in and out, whatever. But I couldn't leave, Karen. Because the vision had been in my mind repeatedly so many times. So once it had kind of cleared out, the guard was still there. I was pretending, oh my God, it's so weird to say that. I was pretending that I was taking some pictures, like as I was lowering down, until I finally sat and kneeled down. And then I sat there and I was like, okay, I'm down now, Carla. You're down now. Just relax and no one's in the room. And so I spent the time that I needed to spend meditating on my knees. I put everything down and did the moment with her. When I got up, there was no one in the room. The guard was gone. Everyone was gone. Everything. So I was very proud of myself because I too was very nervous of people, just,
thinking
having
you're
people are
crazy.
there. Yeah, people are there,
Thinking
but
you're crazy.
also like they're talking and, it's like the energy. Isn't that amazing?
Our conversation is making me cry.
Oh.
I got tears coming down my eyes, remembering all of this and hearing you and sharing this. It's profound. I mean, and I think that's why, after having these experiences, and I'm sure that what motivates you as well, I wanted to go home and bring people back to experience this for themselves, because I felt like, this isn't just mythology. This is real energy. And women have to stand in places where goddess was revered at the center of their world, and remember, and maybe one day we can make this blossom again,
There is a call. There is a call, like so in on my TikTok. Because I post so many temple sites, there is always someone or many people who are like, we need to rebuild this. We need to have spaces again. There is a call for that. I mean, whether that time is now or whether that time is coming, but I'm seeing more and more and more of a call for having spaces for us to worship the gods and the goddesses, but even all the old gods as well. So there seems to be that call. I don't know if you feel that. Because now, so. Now you're doing work on ISIS and other work. So, how does that resonate?
Depending on the day you ask me, it's how do I identify goddess, right? I mean, when I first got into this, here I was, a woman from the Bible Belt who knew nothing about the sacred feminine. They kept us so ignorant. I didn't know anything about patriarchy, misogyny, nothing. All the more reason when I did discover all of this, I wanted to shout it from the friggin' rooftops, right? Because it made me so angry that I had lived till I was 30 years old with none of this knowledge. I f was angry that this was kept from me and from other women. And I really became so angry with Christianity for such a long time. But it shifted. I started to see Isis and Osiris as archetypes, like Mary Magdalene and Jesus. I started seeing Jesus's teachings as hand in glove with goddess values. I mellowed, right? But Depending on the day you talk to me, sometimes I see goddess as like a monolith, one energy, like a friend of mine called it like a diamond with many facets or a tree with many branches,
Beautiful.
Sometimes I see goddess like that. Sometimes I've started to see her as just an indifferent energy that is maybe helping us ascend and evolve as humans. Because, now people are talking about frequency and vibration. And it's interesting that the frequency and vibration you have to emulate are the goddess values, It's funny how that connects. So I guess what I'm saying is, I don't care if it's an Isis temple or it's an Artemis temple or it's a Gaia temple or if it's a humongous 500-year-old tree that we're going to say that we're going to call the sacred feminine. I think we just have to name it, recognize the sacred feminine, adopt her values. And maybe that's how it starts. I don't think we, it would be nice if, yeah, we could go to, Las Vegas and see Sekhmet, and we could go to Los Angeles and see Isis. I mean, you can almost do that. You can take my book and do a West Coast goddess tour, honestly,
That would be amazing, yeah.
and go down the coast, and hit site after site after site, And there's other places too in the United States that I name in the book, but I don't know. Did that answer your question about, am I more focused on Isis than, say, Artemis or something like that?
Yeah, no, I think what you're saying is very valid because I talk about Artemis a lot, but it's true that and that's sort of it's almost like I think of Artemis as my mentor, my guide, my bestie, right? This kind of thing. Like there's a personal relationship with that divine
Yeah, and same with me and
entity,
Isis.
right? But when you're traveling and you go to the temple of Demeter or when you go to the temple of whoever, even Sekhmet, like I was not expecting Sekhmet to come so strong for me in some places at some times. And so I agree with you. I think that th that is the vibration and the frequency of the sacred feminine. And however you have or whoever you have a relationship with is an embodiment that perhaps fits who you are or where you are in life or your experience or whatever. I think that's the way the ancients understood their gods too, because that's what polytheism is. It's like, right? The different incarnations of the divine that allow you a multiple experience of the divine.
And it makes sense that way. I mean, I think of goddess as the poster girl for diversity, because you see her different faces, her different skin colors, her differences is the beauty of it too. And it doesn't, and so many of their attributes overlap anyway. Or you have these syncretized versions of, like, I remember the Aphrodite Isis statue in one of the Greek museums, And then you even have the hermaphrodite goddess statues, which are rare, which I wondered if they, if those were not telling us about the sacred feminine and sacred masculine within ourselves, But it feels like, especially now with the anti-trans movement is so ridiculous. It's just such ignorance, right? And I mean, when I was researching the Sacred Places book, one of the things I stumbled on, and you probably know more about this than me, was some of the very earliest gods were hermaphrodite. And then later we divided them into male or female deities.
This is very Plato, very ancient.
And so wouldn't it be something if our evolution is not about gender anymore? We go back, we come back full circle, and it's really about us embodying both within ourselves. And the trans people who are being marginalized and demonized now, maybe they're closer to evolution than the people that are living in this narrow box of, there's only two genders. They don't even see gender as a spectrum.
I love that. I love, love, love that. And I think you're absolutely, one of the gods that speaks to me like that is Dionysus. And it's one of the reasons why, on my social media, I don't like to post male gods, but Dionysus, and maybe Asclepius every now and then, is because he has always been to me like they, always, right? Like, and there are sculptures that I found of him that are very clearly, I don't even know what the term would have been in the ancient world, but are very clearly an embodiment of the complexities of what it means to be human and gendered. And he's got, different genitalia, male, female genitalia mix. He's sort of, what do you call it? Pushing all of the, what we would call gender binaries in so many of his depictions. So that tells us that the ancients, obviously, who sculpted this, had a lot of that intention in mind, and also that this was something that was beautifully admired, and this is something that was very much a part of the culture. I don't think that ancient people were as well Christianized. Clearly, they were not. You know what I mean? That I think that there is that division. I also think that there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of misunderstanding. There's a lot of fear.
Well, they're marketing fear. I mean,
Yes,
they
yes,
market fear,
yes, yes,
and rather, and they're making people afraid of things that
yes,
are not like themselves,
yes,
and
yes.
rather than see it, I mean, what happened to education? What happened to being a seeker of
Yes.
wanting understanding, But I don't know. I feel like, I don't know if you remember Sarah Palin, but that's when I really started noticing that education was not being valued anymore,
Yes. Yes.
But going back to, you said Dionysus, you reminded me of Shiva. Look how androgynous Shiva
Yes.
looks,
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. I have no doubt. I mean, there's lots of documentation that the spectrum was not conceptualized the way we think about it, but it was very much a part of the ancient understanding of the human experience
Well,
and
look at
men.
the guys who would, cut off their
Yeah,
penis to
that's right.
be Kabbali devotees,
That's right. That's right. And
and
Inanna devotees, and right? And they lived as women. I say that in quotation marks. You know what I mean? They were allowed in the sacred spaces of women. They were, So I think, yeah, we certainly need to catch up. But I also think there's a fear of like there isn't enough space for all of us. Do you know what I mean? It's almost like, again, it's like getting the rich or the politicians or whoever's in control gets all of us to fight amongst ourselves over the scraps, what appears to be scraps of space. And of course, I always feel like there's enough space for all of us at the table. We all belong.
Scarcity mentality.
Yes.
Rhea Eisler talks about the dominator pyramid, and it's the people at the top,
Yeah.
the billionaires, or Bernie
Yeah.
Sanders, the 99% versus the 1%. The billionaires are the 1%. They're at the top of the dominator pyramid, and we're at the bottom fighting for the scraps,
Right? And they're like, oh, that's your enemy. The trans people are your women. The trans people are trying to take your women's spaces. And I'm like, no, actually, you're trying to take my woman's space. What I'm saying? You're passing policy, legislation, blah, 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 of over,
And I've had this very heated conversation with goddess women, who were anti-trans, and they don't realize that this rhetoric that they're spouting, because they think that there's going to be an erasure of women, which I think is absurd. I mean, it's like about as real as the war on Christmas. I would say it's the Heritage Foundation that has put out that rhetoric. It's the Tucker Carlsons who have promoted that rhetoric. These are people that would burn you at the stake, and you're
Yes.
going to align yourself with them.
Yes.
It's crazy to me,
Yes.
But also too, Carla, tell me if I hope I haven't been saying this erroneously, but in ancient Greece, I don't even think there was a word for homosexuality, right? I mean, it was just a common thing. It wasn't an abomination. It wasn't, you weren't marginalized
Oh,
if
no.
you,
No. I mean, Aristotle says it very clearly. We enjoy women for procreation and we enjoy men for eroticism. I mean, this is not hidden. This is not, and there's lots of scholars that actually also believe, although we don't have as much evidence, that women were enjoying each other's companies as well in an intimate way. No, this was not something that was frowned upon. And it's cross-cultural. I mean, speaking of Japan, in Japan, they had similar relationships all over the world. Humans were intimate with whoever they wanted and however they wanted, because they didn't have this kind of mentality that comes, like I said, later with monotheism.
Well, I wonder if it had something to do with the cultural mores, and it might vary from culture to culture, but I'll tell you what we experienced in Egypt. We were in a restaurant one night. My husband walked into the men's bathroom and there was a fight going on. And a lot of details, but our tour guide ended up telling us that it was two men fighting over each other. And because just normal dating, like we would say, have in the United States, and I guess in Canada too, normal dating is not allowed. So men and women don't get to mix, in schools and go to dances and get to know each other just as people, as friends. And so they end up marrying somebody that they barely know. So until that marriage is maybe arranged by their families for whatever reason, they're, the people that they are close to are people of their own sex. And because they can't break the, break these strict patriarchal religious, societal conformity laws. So, you love the one you with kind of a thing, the people you spend the most time with. Maybe it's just that simple.
Yes. I mean, that's, the Spartans encouraged relationships in their militaries because I think from a leader perspective, it makes sense that they bond and therefore fight and support each other. But also from the fact that you've got 100, 1,000 men that need some type of intimacy and bonding, and you're out, for years. And also, I think it just came very naturally, and it wasn't even something, And so people sometimes talk about, oh, well, Spartans were big and tough and masculine. Yes, and they also really enjoyed other men. And they wouldn't have defined themselves as gay. I mean, they didn't have that language because they had wives or were planning to get married as well. And so I actually think that this is the ideal way to live, that you can love who you want and you can be who you want. And I'm not saying, of course, the ancient world had its own problems for, certainly once we entered patriarchy with women. But as far as sexuality and intimacy and things like that, there were lots of different ways that we can learn from. We're much more open.
Because I mean, I learned about a man and a woman would invite their friends, and I think one of the the marriage acts was they would have sex on their land in front of other people. And it was to invite the fertility of the land and the crops and the animals, And imagine if we did that here,
Lots of sex on the land. Lots of sex on the land. Very much encouraged. Lots of sex in temples. Lots of sex on the land. And and we today, even today, we call that temple prostitution or priestess prostitution. So that associating that word again brings this negativity, right? When it was really just, yeah. Do what you like. This is the time to enjoy each other's bodies and to enjoy, I'm not sure that we can really wrap our minds around what it must have been like to live in a society that wasn't raised that wasn't indoctrinated with monotheistic limitations, you know?
Yeah.
I survived Catholicism, so you know, that sort of, I came out of that tradition, and the guilt, like the sin,
Shame.
you know, yeah,
Shame.
all
Yeah.
of that. I can't say it has influenced me personally, but it's so much in the air, and it
Yeah.
was so much a part of my life because I went to Catholic school,
Yeah, me
even
too.
though we were quite wild, you know. Like there's this sort of hypocrisy almost, because we were so wild, but we were so restricted. There
Yeah,
was so
yeah.
much shame and there was so much guilt, like
Yeah.
this
Well, and
thing.
it might be that monogamy is not natural either,
Agreed.
you
Oh,
know.
agreed.
But, you know, I don't say this very often, but I feel like I should say it now. Getting back to the temples, the temples of prostitution.
Yeah.
Again, you know, let's say we need to reclaim that word and put it in a positive light, because I think the ancient people realized through sex you had this, you know, that orgasmic maybe in connection to the divine, I think they called it. But I've often thought, and again, you know, we're probably hundreds of years from being able to accept an idea like this. But imagine if when a young guy or a young girl reached puberty, they were sent to a sacred temple of sexuality to learn about their body, to learn how to pleasure themselves, to learn how to pleasure other people, to learn about birth control, to learn about abortion, you know, all of it. And, you know, a sex ed temple. And, you know, maybe it wouldn't be taboo to learn about masturbation or same-sex sexuality. And then we wouldn't have all of this craziness around sex, you
Yes,
know?
yes,
I,
yeah.
you know, have you ever wondered if maybe that's what it was really like? Or, I mean, I've heard there's no evidence of what the temples of prostitution really were.
Yes. So this is the dilemma. And as you know, our dilemma is that all of our ancient sources were written by men, and men in who were trying to consciously edit their work to present a certain culture or society that they were living in. So while women for sure wrote and other people wrote, we don't have all of that, especially with the burning of the Library of Alexandria. But there are sort of educated rumors that these were places where you could learn all of the things that you've mentioned, where you were allowed to enjoy sex, where you were allowed to talk about abortion. I mean, that we know that that was happening. We know that they had condoms made out of sheep intestine from, you know, Minoan times. So clearly they understood how to prevent a birth if they wanted to. Again, we don't have any issues around virginity. That word was totally hijacked by Christianity and turned into the hymen virginity rather than piety and non-marriage, you know. So they didn't have these concerns. Are you a virgin? Are you not a virgin? How many, you know? And to be fair, though, and to be historical, the Athenians certainly had some very restrictive ideas of sex as they move forward in time. And that was more about citizenship. Like they had to get married to a Greek citizen woman, and she, you know, they made sure she didn't have other children because those children had to be Greek citizens. So it becomes a political, again, the women's body and a man's body, and I suppose procreation becomes political. Then we enter these more restrictive aspects, right? And then we have inheritance rights. So there's a lot of that, those layers as well. But I think, I mean, and this is my opinion, there's maybe historians who disagree, but I think that certainly in the Greek times, in that, let's say, 1,000 years, there was a great deal of enjoyment of sex and emphasis
Yeah.
on enjoyment of sex. And then, yes, as we move forward through time, it seems like things become more and more corrupted by political agenda, power, blah, blah, blah. As we move backwards in time, I mean, for us, for example, here in Canada, we talk a lot about that native concept of the two-spirited people, right? So that, you know, a person can have these sort of two selves, and a lot of that shows up in gender performance, and that's okay. And they've had that history that concept for thousands of years,
Yeah.
right? So when we talk about people today and sexuality today, there's nothing new. Sometimes people say to me, "Oh my God, now everybody's gay." And my answer is, we've always been gay. We just never called it gay.
Yeah.
We've always, so if we go back further and further and further, people just kind of enjoyed, and same with monogamy. I mean, you could choose monogamy. I'm not saying that people were anti-monogamy in the past. And here we're talking pre-Greek times. But you could also have a couple of husbands. The Spartan women had a couple of husbands. That was encouraged, at least. You could have a few husbands. You can have a few lovers. You could, have children with different people. And so lots of that was much more
Yeah.
open. We have
Yeah.
lots to learn from that. But then, of course,
Yeah.
we're dismissed as primitive. And I say that in quotations, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Primitive.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, that's what they do over there because they're not as hoity-toity as
Oh,
us.
those heathen
That's
pagans,
right.
you know? Yeah, education. Oh my God. Education would solve so much, wouldn't it?
Yes.
But you know what? People have to be intellectually curious.
True.
And so many people just are not. I mean, I hate, I know this is going to sound like a put down for my family, but sometimes I think I must have been left in a basket at the doorstep because I mean, I was just nothing like my family. My family didn't care about anything beyond, I don't know, 10 miles beyond their city. You know, they didn't travel. They didn't. And here I was, looking at books on ancient cultures, and maybe it was past life stuff I was tapping into, But here I was, I find it interesting that I was looking at these books on Egypt and the Manat collars, that you'd see the priestesses wear with the cornelian and the lapis lazuli. I mean, I was like a dog with a bone looking at pictures like that. And then I find, and then so I was into the ancient culture thing, and then the Isis thing, and then the Isis priestess thing. And then I find out, well, when the women of ancient times wore that collar, they were like the priestess embodiment of the goddess.
Yeah.
And I, wow, was that a past life memory?
Yes.
Or was
Yeah.
it a coincidence,
I love that. And for me, this is why I go to speak certainly about the goddess, but certainly about Artemis anywhere where I'm invited. Because actually, Karen, you just reminded me that if a Christian group invites me to speak about the goddess in the ancient world, I will go. If any group invites me, as long as they're, I wouldn't go to the KKK or something like that. There's no violent oppression in their history. But groups, well, now that I'm saying that about Christians, who knows, right?
I get what you mean though.
So it's like
They're
maybe
safe, but they have to be safe.
case by case basis. But what I mean is, if there's a curiosity within a group that are saying, Carla, we'd like you to come and talk about the goddess, even if I may not agree with all of your values, I absolutely think that there will be people in that group that may go, oh my God, this, something maybe in my talk or about the goddess or a symbol, like you say, or something might go, oh my God, that's fascinating. I'm going to follow that down.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of our job is to, I know for sure for me, it's like the goddess says to me, well, wherever you go, talk about me, make sure, you're talking about me and saying things.
Yeah. Planting the seeds. Planting the
Right,
seeds.
right, right, and have the conversations.
I want to tell you about an Artemis miracle.
Oh, yes.
Well, first of all, I want to say I do. Because of this guy I'm going to tell you about, I did learn much, 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 much more about Artemis than I ever expected to, because I so respected him. And when I mention his name, you may know him. But
Is it James?
I think Isis and Artemis are like the two powerhouse goddesses, right? I mean, I'm biased, you're biased, but I mean, but people need to realize that Artemis was so powerful that Zeus would have Artemis in his hand, because he wanted to draw on some of her power, So I think that was a time, just like with Sometimes I think it's just like with Kali, wasn't it? Was it Kali or Durga? I get those two mixed up. When the gods failed to get rid of evil, they had to call on either Kali or Durga. I forget
I think it's
which one.
Kelly. I think it's Kelly,
It,
yeah.
yeah. So it took Kali to defeat evil. So Artemis and Isis, they were like, the ultimate goddess. Bear with me. I'm biased, but anyway. So this, I'll say his name. His name is James Rietveld, and oh, I'm so sorry about this. I can't turn it off. So will you be able to edit this out? Can
What is it?
you hear the ringing?
No.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I won't worry about it. The phone was ringing.
Okay.
So anyway, so he taught me a lot about Artemis. We were really good friends, and we spent many, 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 many hours in what we called wisdom circle salons, and we talked about a lot of the things you and I are talking about. And anyway, he was preparing his dissertation on Artemis, and he went there to visit her sacred sites and to experience it firsthand. And he went there with a stutter. He had had a stutter all of his life.
Went where?
He did. He had a stutter,
No, but I mean,
and
where did he go? To
oh, I'm
Greece?
sorry. I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you. He went to Greece, and he went to Ephesus. He went to a lot of the Artemis sites because he wanted to stand in her sites, get a feel for the landscape as he was writing this seminal book on Artemis, right?
Right.
And he felt very connected to her and taught us about the Ephesian letters and all of that sort of stuff. Anyway, he went there with a stutter. And he fell asleep at some of her sacred sites. And when he was there alone, like we were talking about, you can find these places alone. He came back, and as far as I know, he never stuttered again.
Wow.
And then he went out, he became a teacher, and he was promoting his book. And he's a scholar now. And I hope I'm not outing him. But that stutter, I mean, he probably could not have done his work as a teacher, as a scholar, with that stutter,
Right.
And it's like that stutter was now gone. I think, I'm not saying he believes this, I believe she cured him.
Yeah.
She saw he had a journey and a mission on her behalf, and she took care of him. And I don't know, I believe Goddess does do that. I mean, I can look to things in my life and feel like, yeah, she had me in her golden wings. She was, yeah, it was difficult, but I was protected and I came out okay on the other end,
Yes. So this actually brings me to then asking you about your relationship with Isis, and how, yeah, anything you'd like to share about that.
Wow. Well, like I said, I started off ignorant in the Bible Belt, found Goddess, and it was just a slippery slope for me. Once I discovered Goddess, I went to a fluff, I'll call it a fluff class in Los Angeles about Goddess, the Goddess Within, or something like that. And some of these classes are horribly frivolous and deluded. But it opened the door, and I started then seeing women who took goddess spirituality more seriously, and it was part of their spirituality. And the women from the Fellowship of Isis were the ones that we connected.
Interesting.
And I feel like her hand is in everything, and so it felt a natural connection. And so I learned about Goddess, and she was my focus, and started, I had an Iseum within the Fellowship of Isis, and you could either have an Iseum or a Lyceum, and that meant that you held classes and did rituals and to teach about Goddess or magic or history or mythology, whatever. And it was in that Within that container, I started doing sacred tours and started writing books. I mean, it became the focus of my life. And when I kind of straddled the fence between, am I a left brain self-taught scholar or am I a devotee? And the two often overlap so much. And I did. I had some, like I said, it wasn't every day, but I had these incredible experiences that couldn't be explained any other way than something really happened, I remember once I was taking a class on what we called aspecting, but it would probably be called channeling. And I'll tell you, Carla, I didn't believe in stuff like that. And I didn't think I could do it because I'm this left brain Virgo. But I had to do the class and I wanted to do the class. And the process was they would lead us through a meditation. In front of us in the classroom, there was a beautiful chair decked out with beautiful cloths and furs, and that was the throne of the goddess. And in this meditation, we were going to visualize that as the throne of whoever our goddess was. And of course, I was visualizing Isis, right? And we each, there were only six of us in the class, they kept the classes really small. And we were supposed to, in our turn, go sit in that chair and aspect or channel. Like I tell you, I was scared to death because I figured I'd be the only failure in the class, right? And I will say, I was sleep deprived and I was food deprived. And I still wonder if that didn't help the process. It came time for me to sit in the chair. And, obviously, I've kind of given it away, but it happened. I sat in the chair. And I don't know what it was, but this is a movement that has stuck with me during these ritual experiences, let's call them. I did this, I put my hands under the beautiful cloths and the furs, and I crossed them over the front of me. Like you see a lot of the images of Isis with her wings, where she's crossed in front of her body. And as soon as I did that, it was like a trigger. And suddenly I knew I was there, but I also knew something else was happening. Ideas started to flood my brain. And it was not ideas that I would normally have thought of on my own. And I then, it's like my body wasn't totally mine, but again, I was still there. And I looked at the other five women, eyeball to eyeball, and it was like I was speaking and I was saying, "You are all my daughters. You are all doing my work. Though you take different paths, you all do my work." And it was just this incredible thing. And that's what I remember most. I might have said something else, but then it was over. And you know what? I was totally depleted, totally depleted. And I was emotional wreck from the sense that I was filled with joy, exhaustion, wonder. Something had just physically happened to me that had never ever happened to me before. And I'm sorry, I don't know how else to describe that other than we hooked up,
That's incredible.
So there's been some times like that, but I think that was the first one. And another time was in a dentist chair. Do you want me to tell the story?
Sure, I think we could go another 10 minutes or so.
Okay, so I'll make it quick. I was really worried about this dental procedure I had to have. I know, probably sounds crazy. It was a root canal, but I was worried that, for reasons I won't share, that I was worried that I was going to bleed out on the dentist chair. So on the way to the dentist, I was saying these mantras to Isis, to Thoth, to Sekhmet, over and over and over and over and over and over and over. And when I got to the dentist's office, my husband drove me. The nurse, calls me and she says, "The dentist is running late," but she makes this gesture. She said, "Why don't you take a look at some of these magazines and have a seat here while you wait?" She gestured, and it was directly to a National Geographic with Isis on the cover.
Wow.
I picked up the National Geographic, of course. I sat in the chair that the procedure was going to happen in. I put the National Geographic on my lap. I randomly flipped it open. It had opened to the article on Isis with a big picture of her that was on the front on the page.
Wow.
I put my hand on her and I continued to say the mantras over and over again. So the dentist came. He gave me the injection. I didn't feel the injection. I felt nothing but pressure in my mouth the entire time. I had an experience that the chair became her body and I was laying on her
Oh.
and she took her wings and wrapped them over me. I felt like Thoth was in the corner of the room. Didn't see him, it was a sense of him. And I heard in my mind, "You have nothing to fear. It's going to be okay. You have much to do."
Wow, Karen.
I got out of the chair and I had that same feeling that I had after that aspecting. I was depleted. I was exhausted. I was crying. I was in wonder, awe, disbelief. And I knew something had happened. And I'm almost afraid to tell people this because I'm afraid they're going to think I'm a psycho. But you know what? It happened. And I believe she was there for me and continues to be there for me. Because, I think we have a reciprocal relationship with the energies, I think they work through us and we are here to make the world a better place in their name. And they protect us while we do it.
I
So I'm sorry, it just.
no. No, it's okay. It's okay. And I agree with you. One of the hardest thing for me to say was that Artemis and I are collaborating because I felt like this was a sin. Because how dare do you see a god or a divine being as your friend, as your mentor, as your personal collaborator? And it took, I totally understand what you're saying. And the experiences that I've had confirm that this is a relationship that is, I don't know how to explain it, but on a friendly basis without the bow down and be afraid and be punished. You know how many times I say to myself, oh, I'm so sorry, goddess, for this. And then the echoes is like, don't apologize. We're not in that place. Just do what you need to, you know? So, and I think we need to speak more about it, Karen, because, people in monotheism share their miracle stories, and I'm not saying that they're not, but they share their experiences and everybody applauds. And you have an experience, I have an experience, we goddess worshipers and other pagan worshipers have experiences. People go, oh, well, that's just your brain or that's just your fear. Do you know what I mean? And there's a double standard there. And the more we share, and the more we go, no. My experience is just as valid as Joe who saw Mary on a piece of toast or Jesus
Or the apostles.
or whatever. Just as, it's fine. They can have their experience, but then you have to acknowledge that I have my experience as well.
Well, thank you. Thank you for reminding me of that because I do believe it. And, I felt like, I have a little bit more freedom to say stuff like that than, say, someone who is trying to get a job in academia,
Oh, oof, yeah.
because I know people who have used the Ephesian letters and they believe that Artemis appeared to them. By properly pronouncing and practicing the cadence and all of that, and who's to say that's not true?
Exactly.
Right. And about what you just said, before we go, one of the things I always try to remind women is to take our authority, our autonomy, our authority as women to rewrite the sacred stories, because so many of these patriarchal stories are still shaping our culture and mythology. I mean, just look at the, Adam and Eve story. Eve's story still shapes patriarchy, Christianity, blah, blah, blah. We really have to take control of the stories for our daughters. So that there is a different narrative out there. And I think about the good job as an example, the good job that the Mary Magdalene people have done, taking that story of Mary Magdalene, that she married Jesus and they had children and yada, yada, yada. Because you know what? Now people hardly even equate Mary Magdalene with being the repentant prostitute. They have changed the narrative. And I think we really do have to rewrite the stories, because we have just as much right to write those stories. We could be divinely guided, just like those apostles were and
Yeah.
those ancient people did. It's our time now to rewrite the stories. Women out there, listen,
I got
please rewrite the sacred stories.
Karen, you're giving me chills. I just had chills. I love that. It's our time now to rewrite the sacred stories, Karen. Well, I think that's a full stop right there.
Okay. This has been so much fun. You and I could go on forever.
We could, and we may have to do a part two. We may have to do
Okay.
a part two
Okay.
to dig more through storytelling and things. But yeah, so I wanna thank you for being here. And I'll put all your information below in the description so that our viewers know where to find it and where to find
Thank you.
you. And yeah, thank you for being here. Thank you so much for sharing your stories
My
so
pleasure.
openly.
My pleasure. And obviously, I had such a good time. So thank you. It's wonderful to speak with someone so knowledgeable about the subject, and it can be a two-way conversation, So yeah, thank you for having me on the show. I hope your listeners enjoy it, and I hope they'll check out my website, my podcast, and all the rest.
And your book and all of those things, which I'll
Yeah.
put below. Yes. All right. Thank you. All right, y'all.
Okay.
See you all later.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.